Where we've gotten into trouble is when we've got these kids that are out of control. Mm-hmm. My term for it is incredible hulking. That they get upset and it's like Bruce Banner is gone. Mm-hmm. Now you're dealing with the Hulk. Mm-hmm. And it just turns into this episode of rage, and you can't reason with them. We used to say, oh, that must be what bipolar looks like in kids. Mm-hmm. So we would call that bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's where you've heard all of the media and the research and all of that. Oh, bipolar disorder is overdiagnosed in kids. I would say that's true. Mm-hmm. And I would say that is the reason why, is because we didn't know what to call it.
Makes sense.
We still don't fully know what to call it. We're trying, we're working on it. The new diagnosis that is in the DSM-5 mm-hmm. is disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, DMDD.
Wow.
And there's a lot of controversy over that one because it's only recently been defined. We really don't have any great studies on it yet, other than that's what we're naming it right now. Mm-hmm. That is probably what most of those overdiagnoses met, were mm-hmm. that DMDD diagnosis. Mm-hmm.
That's child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Brian Luberstedt. He's our guest today on this edition of Fresh Hope for Mental Health. Maybe you have a child who does incredible hulking, or you're very concerned about your child and not sure how to help them, or maybe you feel like you're failing as a parent. Well, in any case, this is a podcast that you're going to want to listen to. As Dr. Bride and I cover these topics regarding children and mental health and more on this edition of Fresh Hope for Mental Health. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Fresh Hope for Mental Health. I'm Brad Hafes, your host for today, and I have a very special guest with me in the studio, and I'm very happy to have him. His name is Dr. Brian Luberstedt. I said I'd say it right once, and I haven't even done it yet. I say it the very German way, Luberstedt. There. Did I get it close?
Yes.
Okay. But he said it was okay if I call him Dr. Brian, and I'm glad to have you today. Thank you very much for being here. Dr. Brian is a psychiatrist, and so he's a medical doctor first with a specialty in psychiatry, and he's also board certified for children and teenagers, right?
Or correct.
Young adults, or how do they say that?
The term we use is child and adolescent.
Okay, child and adolescent. He was just telling me that he has in his practice about 2/3 of the patients he sees or the clients he sees are children. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct.
So every day, about 2/3 of who comes into your office are kids.
18 and under, and probably a mixture of teenagers to kids, roughly half and half.
Oh, wow. That's something. Today, I want to talk to you specifically about children. But before we do that, he has some more important titles than doctor, I think. He's a dad, and he's also a husband, which is a good thing to be a husband first and then a dad, right? So you want to tell us just a little bit about your family?
Yeah, I've been married for 16 years, and I have 3 kids. Elijah is 13, my daughter Calla just turned 11, and then my son Jonah is 9.
Yeah, I've met him. They're great kids, and he has a beautiful wife. The two of you have been married, you said, 16 years?
16 years.
Yeah. And they are both committed Christians. And so we're really glad when we can talk with a man of God, as well as somebody who knows science and medicine and psychiatry in particular. So thank you so much for being here.
That's my pleasure.
Well, first of all, talk to me about, you know, I've heard these statistics in the United States that 1 out of 5 children suffers from a significant mental health diagnosis. Tell me what you think about that, or where are we with children in the United States today? And I think that's probably 18 and under, those statistics.
That would be the definition would be, yeah, 18 and under. We have about 1 in 5, and I'd say that number is pretty accurate, but probably not representative of how many we actually come in contact with.
Right.
A lot of those are going to be seen by their pediatricians, or they're not going to be seen at all.
Mm.
The majority of those 1 in 5 are going to be ADHD. That's going to be the most common psychiatric diagnosis in children.
Okay.
That's going to be roughly 8% or so. And then the rest is going to be made up of depression, anxiety, behavior disorders, autism, all of those things, I think, have been pretty static, other than autism. For some unknown reason, the incidence of that is going up.
Right.
But the rest of them, I think, have remained pretty static. People hear that number 1 in 5 and think, oh my goodness, you know, this is what's going on in our world today. And in fact, it probably really is not a true increase or a change. It's just that we're more aware of it now.
Yeah. And we talk about it more, maybe.
Hopefully more openly.
Right. Talk to me just a little bit about the connection with ADHD, or I know I've heard sometimes that ADHD and bipolar disorder can look a lot alike in adults, or just tell me a little bit about that.
Well, ADHD is a little bit tricky. It's neurologic in origin. And so part of it is it truly is something we can look at on brain scans. We can diagnose it through other means than just doing, you know, in-office interviews, although most of the research shows that the in-office interviews are as accurate as brain scans are, as long as you do a good, thorough job. And the issue is that most of what I do ends up being on the behavioral side of things. So I'm actually board certified under the Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. So neurologists are all under the same board certification that I'm under. They've had the bulk of their training in neurology, even though ADHD truly is more of a neurologic process, because it comes out behaviorally, it comes my direction.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. And autism would be the same way, as far as it becomes a behavioral thing and they end up coming to you first, or?
Right. And it depends on how it presents. Autism mm-hmm. can show up a lot of different ways. It can show up as social skills deficits. Mm-hmm. That a lot of times will be picked up by the pediatrician. I won't ever see those kids, because they'll go to more of a behavioral specialist or someone that'll work directly with social skills.
Right.
If it comes out as a behavioral problem, then that's where I see those kids.
That you work with them. Well, tell me if somebody's a parent out there and they're concerned about their child, or that they're wondering, talk to me a little bit about how many times something presents itself. I know there's probably so many different ways, but like, for instance, let's just take depression. How could depression show up for a child, and what might parents be looking for?
Most commonly in really young kids, it's going to be seen more in behavioral difficulties. In fact, most of what I see takes a little bit of detective work, because if kids are ADHD, they act out. If mm-hmm. they're not sleeping well, they act out. If they're being bullied at school, they act out. If they're depressed, they act out. We're getting a theme here.
Yeah, really.
And so what we end up seeing then is, more specifically, above just the acting out, sad moods certainly can happen, withdrawal socially. They'll hold themselves away a little bit more. A change in behavior is really what we're going to key in on more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So little Timmy was doing fine, and then all of a sudden it seems like he's a lot more irritable with the family. And I would say that's one of the moods that's often overlooked in kids, is it's a lot more often to present as irritability as opposed to sadness.
Uh-huh.
And so he's irritable. He's just wanting to spend time on his own. He's really not eating well. He's not sleeping like he was. So there's a lot of physical symptoms that come out as well, with energy level being lower, appetite being decreased. A lot of times concentration isn't as sharp. Kids just become more withdrawn, kind of turn inward and start to detach. Mm. And that's a lot of times where we'll start to see it.
So those are things that you would see with depression. Are those also things that you would see with ADHD, or, you know, bipolar, or any kind of mood issues, or?
Well, a lot of times the acting out is kind of the first key that something's going on. ADHD, for example, most of that is going to come either from the parents recognizing from very early on that the kid was unusually hyper compared to other kids his age, mm-hmm. unusually rough in his play. The teachers early on said, you know, all the other kids can sit and listen to story time, but your kid really can't sit for more than 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. And where I oftentimes will see it is when it starts really getting in the way School a lot of times will be an early source to catch it. When the kids are falling behind, they're not learning the things that they need to learn because they can't stay with it long enough to really have any of it sink in. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my practice comes from referrals. Mm-hmm. And so I have a lot that will come from therapists in the community, from teachers suggesting to the parents, hey, maybe you'd want to see somebody about this, or even the teachers having the school psychologist involved and then them digging a little bit more, deciding that maybe there's more intervention needed. Pediatricians as well, they vary a lot in their comfort level as far as diagnosing and treating ADHD. That ends up being pretty common, so most pediatricians are going to be pretty good at that. But what if the first thing they try doesn't work? Mm-hmm. Well, they haven't had as extensive of training, and so a lot of times, if the few things they know how to do that usually work great, if that doesn't work, then they'll send them on to me as the expert. Or mm-hmm. a lot of times depression just gets a little more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot less comfortable to treat because there's risks involved to the medicines. And if a kid's got anxiety, got depression, things like that, sometimes they'll treat. A lot of times they'll send them on to me because that's something that, again, I've had a lot of training on and mm-hmm. am fairly comfortable with.
Now, does anxiety, for instance, when a child has anxiety, does that also show up a lot like irritability for them? Are the depression, anxiety symptoms somewhat similar, or do you find anything in particular with anxiety that would stand out?
Anxiety and depression actually come from a very similar chemical process in the brain. And so you're going to see a lot of overlaps with the physical symptoms that I was talking about earlier mm-hmm. with, lack of energy, not sleeping well, focus problems certainly happen with both of them as well. Anxiety, a lot of times when I see that, the kids are going to be, I'm going to get a story from the parents that they've always been a little bit more shy. They've always been a little bit more inhibited. They didn't warm up well to strangers. They were real clingy to mom. They wouldn't let anybody else hold them or, didn't like to get dropped off at daycare. That's normal. That's okay. We don't worry about that. But it crosses a line at some point mm-hmm. where it really starts causing problems and really starts getting in the way. Anxiety for kids, it's just that inability to shut it off. Mm-hmm. You can't mm-hmm. be satisfied with reassurance. And again, is all anxiety going to come and see me? No, it's not. And a lot of times reassurance or telling the kid two or three times that it's going to be okay, having a few thunderstorms that they're awake mm-hmm. through and, mm-hmm. Having them sleep with mom and dad, not a problem. I mean, everybody's probably gone through that themselves mm-hmm. or had a kid that went through it themselves, but it crosses that line at some point. And I talk to my parents and my patients about that a lot, that if we get to the point where we need to do some counseling, where we need to do medication or things like that, where is that line for you? Mm-hmm. Where is that line where, okay, this has gone on long enough. It doesn't seem to be getting better with the things that we know how to do as parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really getting in the way. This kid is miserable and they're mm-hmm. suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point where we need to see them. We need mm-hmm. to talk and we need to go through things. It doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to do anything different, but mm-hmm. we at least need to have eyes on it to talk about it mm-hmm. more.
Huh. Interesting. How much does cognitive therapy or just them changing how they think, I guess I'm just so inexperienced when it comes to dealing with children and this kind of thing. How much can be done with treatment without medicine, for instance, with anxiety, maybe depression?
We've got quite a few studies that mm-hmm. show some different forms of therapy that can be very helpful. Really with kids, that's where we're going to try to start as much as possible. Again, it depends on how much it's getting in the way.
Sure.
Obviously, if a kid is so depressed that they're feeling suicidal, therapy alone probably is not going to be enough to get things better quick enough to make sure that that we're going to be safe.
Sure.
And that's highest priority is always going to be safety. But there are some therapies and studies that show that they work very, very well. A little bit of it depends on the age of the kid, the cognitive level that they're at, intellectually, what can they handle?
Mm-hmm.
Some kids very young are able to really process well for anxiety in particular. You can teach them some different distraction techniques, some coping mm-hmm. skills. Mm-hmm. They really latch on to them and really benefit from them very quickly.
Oh, that's good.
There are some kids that, very young kids, and sometimes whether or not they're really at that certain level, we might lean more on play therapy. Kids will act out in play the things that they're worried about, the things that they're upset about, and the therapist can sit down with them and interact through the play to kind of normalize some of those situations. And so it's a really good type of therapy as well for younger kids. So really depends on the age of the kid, depends on the expertise of the therapist. And we have, you know, several cognitive behavioral approaches that are well studied with the older kids and the teenagers for anxiety and depression. There's even some manuals available that the therapists can use to really make sure they're hitting all the high points that they need to. And again, very well studied.
Now, I'm curious, does it work the same way if with the children and the young adults or teens? Does it work the same way where you would do the medicine part, or do you do the therapy part also with them, or part of it? Or do they see a different, a therapist for any of the cognitive things or the therapies that you were just talking about?
Well, that really comes back to a question you asked earlier that I didn't fully answer, and that is, you know, where is kind of the state of mental health care for kids? If we've got 1 in 5 kids that have a diagnosable behavioral or mental problem, how do we manage that? How are we doing managing that? And the fact of the matter is that we don't have the resources. And so, unfortunately, there is a shortage of child adolescent psychiatrists, as there is a shortage of psychiatrists. I just saw something earlier this week that said that the shortage actually has increased in the last 10 years, despite our best efforts to decrease the shortage and improve access.
Why do you think that is?
I think a little bit of it just lies in when you go to medical school, it's a certain type of person that's going into medical school. It's a scientific mind. It is somebody that wants to, you know, really use that scientific method, use the research, really dig into problems. And unfortunately, with psychiatry, we've got a lot of great research, but our understanding of exactly where everything is coming from is behind a little bit. We can't study the brain the way we can study other organs.
Right.
If you've got a problem with your heart, we can take a sample of it and look at it under a microscope.
Yeah.
I can't do that with the brain.
You can't suck out any of my brain juice and do that, can you?
Not without causing problems.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those areas that it's still locked away from us to some degree. And so because we can't directly look at it, things lag behind a little bit. Now we're way further ahead right now than we've ever been, which is great. But I think that there is a biology, the science behind medicine that people are attracted to. So the biology majors, the chemistry majors, the anatomy and physiology fans, they are the ones going into medicine, not the psychology majors, not the sociology majors. And so there are some of those, and quite a few honestly end up, I think, in psychiatry. But there's this element that people get uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
When you get into a science field, you get the science geeks, and I can call myself one of those, so I can use that term, that as soon as somebody starts to show some emotion, we get uncomfortable.
Yeah, and then what to do with it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so at that point, do you leave the room and say, well, the nurse will be right back? Or do you stay and do you find out what's wrong? And I think that there's where a dividing line is. And I think that's probably a lot of why people don't want to go into it, is they just don't want to deal with
it. So you're kind of a rare person who likes that, as well as you don't mind finding out what's going on and you don't have to call the nurse to come in. And that makes total sense. With that said, then the state of affairs for children's health care is such that you would provide some of the therapy, a child, somebody that specializes in children and adolescents, or how would that work? Or does it vary from office to office?
Yeah, it varies a lot from office to office. Generally speaking, at least in the area that I practice in, most of the child adolescent psychiatrists, the MDs, mainly are doing medication management. There are way too few of us in the United States. Pretty much any community except for the really large metropolitan areas, specifically areas where there's medical schools, some of the residents will graduate and will stay there. But anywhere else in the country, you're going to have shortages. And so, unfortunately, I get relegated to medication management because there are a lot of therapists that can do the therapy. Mm-hmm. Master's level mm-hmm. can do the therapy and can get the training that I've had and are every bit as good, if not probably a little better than I am at it, mainly because I just don't do it all the time. Now, I do have some therapy cases. I do enjoy it quite a bit, but it's a carve out. Mm-hmm. And so with my medication management appointments, those are a lot shorter. And so one therapy appointment is a couple of kids that I could be seeing for medication management. And with just such a high need, people are waiting months to get in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so with that really high need and the fact that there are people available to do the therapy, but not to do the medicines, and we need people to do that because there's so few of us that are able to.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's kind of the state of affairs as I end up doing more of the medicine as opposed to the counseling, which is...
Yeah, and you know, you hear a lot of adults wish that they could spend more time with their doctor just so that they could know, or sometimes people don't even know that it's going to be that way, that there's going to be... You're going to see your psychiatrist for a very short amount of time, and it's going to be focused on medicine. And then they think, well, my psychiatrist doesn't even talk to me or whatever, you know. Yeah, they don't understand. So it would be that way with children. Now, parents, do they always attend the appointment with their child, or does that depend on the situation, or how does that work?
Depends a lot on the situation. It depends on the age of the kid and the comfort level of the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got some of my teenagers that prefer to be there with their parents the whole time. It's kind of their security blanket. They want to have them there.
Sure.
I have some that are pretty young that really, they want just their time with me, you know? And it's kind of like a little bit of a pride thing where like, oh, I'm going to go spend some time with the doctor first. And they really enjoy that. And I enjoy that with them too, because it's amazing how much they will open up and how surprised parents often are when they come back into the room and we kind of just really quickly rehash what we talked about and they say, oh, they told you that. Wow.
Yeah. I, as a parent, probably would have been quite worried about what my kids might have told. I would have said, oh, you only believe half and I'll believe half. So, you know, there's the other things like bipolar disorder. I've heard some doctors say that they would prefer to not have to give diagnoses such as that or many things, because sometimes it can look like one thing and they grow up, they change. What about things like if a child has depression, are they going to have it as an adult? Is that if they, or is when they go through puberty, might it change? Or, and bipolar disorder, for instance.
Yeah, it statistically, most of the disorders are going to be a lot more rare in kids as opposed to adults. So if that you want to look specifically at bipolar disorder, one reason I don't like to diagnose it in kids is because it's very, very rare. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be really, really sure, because it's so rare, that that's what you're actually looking at and it's not something else.
How might that show up for a child?
For a child,
those rare cases.
And that's where some of the disagreement has been. That's where some of the ongoing research is. So bottom line is it's going to look just like it does in an adult.
Hmm.
And when you see that classic mania present in a kid, that is bipolar disorder. They have that rare case. Where we've gotten into trouble is when we've got these kids that are out of control.
Mm-hmm.
My term for it is incredible hulking. That they get upset and it's like Bruce Banner is gone. Mm-hmm. Now you're dealing with the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
And it just turns into this episode of rage, and you can't reason with them. We used to say, oh, that must be what bipolar looks like in kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we would call that bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you've heard all of the media and the research and all of that. Oh, bipolar disorder is overdiagnosed in kids. I would say that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that is the reason why, is because we didn't know what to call it.
Makes sense.
We still don't fully know what to call it. We're trying, we're working on it. The new diagnosis that is in the DSM-5 mm-hmm. is disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, DMDD.
Wow.
And there's a lot of controversy over that one because it's only recently been defined. We really don't have any great studies on it yet, other than that's what we're naming it right now. Mm-hmm. That is probably what most of those overdiagnoses met, were that DMDD diagnosis. Mm-hmm. We're not entirely sure what to do with it yet, though, because you have to name it before you can start studying it.
Right, right.
And we just recently really got the name nailed down a little
and
better.
And it's D-I-M-D-D?
D-M-D-D.
You know, every now and then I have parents that come to Fresh Hope that are that have smaller kids and they're concerned about their children. Oh, my children are going to have bipolar disorder or whatever. One of the things I think that's so important is for parents to know that one of the ways that they can help their children not necessarily develop a case of or develop a mood disorder or whatever is to learn how to handle stress, right? To give them as many coping skills and tools as possible. I mean, not that that would hold it off, but it's kind of like if you know your father has diabetes, then you want to watch what you eat and you want to mm-hmm. do certain things. You may still develop diabetes, but chances are you may hold it at bay also if it's genetically in the family or whatever. Things like bipolar disorder or depression or anxiety disorders. Are there preventative things that parents can help their children with?
Well, I think most of what I tell people is that it's by no means a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got bipolar disorder, yes, your kid has a little bit of a higher chance of developing it. Mm-hmm. But a higher chance, we're talking about something that is 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. So if you doubled their risk, tripled their risk because you have bipolar, you've now shot them from a 1% risk to a 2% risk. Mm-hmm. Chances are they're not going to get it. Mm-hmm. Chances are they're going to be just fine. And those are odds that you would take all day long. Mm-hmm. And so that's a fear I see a lot in my clinic. Mm-hmm. For example, I'll see a kid that has ADHD. Again, very common, 8% of mm-hmm. the population. And the parents will worry, well, I have bipolar disorder. Is this the first stage of them developing it? Mm-hmm. And so we spend a lot of time talking about how ADHD is very, very common. The chances of your kid developing bipolar disorder are very, very low. And mm-hmm. we talk about some of the differences between the two. Mm-hmm. And predominantly the mood issues that you're going to see with bipolar disorder that you're really not going to see with ADHD. And the cyclical nature of it mm-hmm. as well. And hopefully, most of the time, that helps them to feel quite a bit better. But, I mean, we do keep an eye on it as we're treating. I haven't honestly had very many cases that have then turned into bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. It is very rare. And so it is very rare that even I see it. And I see a lot because right. this is what I do for a living.
Right. Yeah. Well, we would hope you'd see more than the general person out there right. in the public. Okay. I want to switch from focusing on the child aspect of it. And because I seriously doubt there's any children listening to this podcast, it's mainly a mom or a dad who's concerned about their child. And I want to approach it from their perspective. First of all, I'm worried sick about my kid. My kid's exhibiting whatever. What should I do? Where should I go first? Help me know. Do I take him to the pediatrician? Do I go to the school counselor? The school counselor's telling me there's issues, blah, blah, blah.
I think you start with the pediatrician. Hopefully that's somebody that you've got a good relationship with, somebody that's known you for a long time, known your kids since they were born. Now, obviously, if you moved into the area, all of that, you may not have that long-standing relationship, but they're going to have a couple of things. Number one, they're going to have the experience. They're going to have seen it before. They're going to know what to do from there, because very rarely does something come into my office that I haven't heard before. Mm-hmm. And the pediatricians are going to be the same way. Mm-hmm. They're going to also have a network. They are going to know, hey, let's start with a therapist. I've got a great person that I know, or okay. I've got a great office that I use. Here's who you use. And then if it gets over to my level, then again, having that network established, who do you go to in town? Mm-hmm. There are some people in town that I would never send anybody to, that I wouldn't want my kid to see. I wouldn't want anybody's kid to see. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is that because we're so short-staffed and just don't have the resources available, some people have made the decision to kind of do flybys. Mm. And you are in for a very short amount of time. Mm. There's not a lot of opportunity to really dig into a problem. It is really throwing medicine at you. Mm. And I think it's just too complex to do that. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it is out there. It does happen. Now, honestly, it is a very small minority in this community, and I hope across the nation. But I know it is out there. And so you want to make sure that your pediatrician gives you a name as opposed to just opening the phone book and throwing a dart at it, or as opposed to calling your insurance company and saying who's covered.
And it might even be a good idea to say to the pediatrician, is this somebody that you would want your own child to see or a grandchild to see?
Yes, the all-important if this were my kid question. Yeah. And that is honestly where I try to base my practice from is, and I pull that one out a lot with people, that if they're trying to decide, if they're not really sure what to do, if it were my kid, here's what I would do. Here's where I would go. And it's okay for parents to ask their pediatrician that question. But I think that's where you start, because that's somebody you know. That's somebody that you trust to take care of your child.
Absolutely.
And hopefully they're going to know some good people in the community that they can then refer you over to, so that you're sure that you're getting somebody safe and you're getting somebody good.
What are possibly some signs that a parent should watch out for regarding, let's say they've gone from the doctor has made a recommendation, the pediatrician, what are some of the signs they should look for that means it's a good working relationship or a good connection with the therapist in your child versus it not being so good? And or maybe it's a therapist you did open the phone book and run your finger down and go, oh, I like that name or whatever. Tell me about what should I be watching for?
I think the first important thing with the therapy is, do you feel that you're being heard? Do you feel like you're understood? We have a lot of studies that have shown, regardless of the type of therapy you're trained in, who trained you, how long you've been practicing, you could have written the book on it. But if you don't have a good relationship, especially with kids, then you're really going to have a hard time. So that connection, that the kid feels comfortable, and that the parent feels like they're being heard too. And again, it depends on the age, but it's not necessary for a five-year-old to love going to the therapist's office. But if they're comfortable there, if the parents feel like they're being understood, I like to have a split where they're spending some time just with the kid if possible, and that it's not just talking to the parents the whole time, because then that turns into more of a teaching session as opposed to really working with the kid directly.
Right.
But I don't want to have somebody that does nothing but go behind closed doors, work with the kid for an hour, and then bring them back out to the parents and say, see you next week. Because then the parent has no opportunity to give feedback and let them know how things are going and what is it that we're working on.
Right.
And that comes around to the second thing. And I think it's really important to come up with a roadmap. You need to know where you're going. Very first session or two, we should be sitting down and talking about, okay, what are our goals? What are we trying to accomplish here? I tell people that we want measurable things. So I want to feel better about myself. Well, great. How do we measure that? We don't. That's totally subjective. That's totally based on what you ate for lunch that day. And so what we want, though, is that, you know, my child is really anxious and they're not able to sleep in their own bed.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we can measure that. If that's a sign of the anxiety, we can measure, okay, how many nights are they spending in their own bed now? How long are they making it in their own bed before they come into yours? We can measure that. And so you want to have some really clear, measurable goals.
Yeah.
You want to revisit those goals from time to time.
Because
you don't want to just be spinning your wheels with the therapist and not really clear on where you're going. You're just having a great old road trip.
Yeah.
But not really knowing if you're ever arriving.
So if my child really doesn't want to go to see the therapist and carries on and, you know, says no, 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 that might be a sign that maybe they're not making, they don't feel safe, or they're not making a good connection with the therapist, or
it could be, or it could be a sign that you've got an oppositional kid and no matter who they go and see,
they
they're not
like,
going to be happy.
I only know from parenting myself and even watching my kids with my grandchildren that parenting can cause a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of unknowns, and kids don't come with instruction manuals. And I always tell people the most important thing you can do with your child is say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong," and fess up to it. Don't pretend like it never happened. And kids know how to press buttons and all that kind of stuff. But when your child, when you're hearing from the school that there's a problem, when you're hearing from the Sunday school that there's a problem, or the church, and then you're hearing from the daycare there's a problem, you can get pretty knotted up pretty quick as a parent, I think. What would you say to them? What would you tell a mom or a dad that's listening today to this, and they're concerned?
I would say what you just said, that kids don't come with instruction manuals. And you are going to parent the only way that you know how, which is how you were parented.
Mm-hmm.
And unless there was something that your parent did that drove you crazy, and then you're going to do the exact opposite. But how many times have things come out of your mouth that you went, "That was my dad," or yeah, "That was my mom"?
Or I said I would never say that. And I
right.
Just said
and
it.
I just said it. And so that is how we parent. Mm-hmm. And kids don't come with instruction books. And sometimes you get a kid that doesn't quite fit your parenting style.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to feel like a failure.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell people all the time, I have had very successful parents come into my office. For example, a couple that has already launched 3 kids. Mm-hmm. They're all married. They all have spouses. They all have kids of their own. And they decide, you know what? We had kids young. We still have energy to give. Let's be foster parents.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful people. Wonderful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they get a difficult foster kid.
Yeah.
And they don't know the first thing to do with that kid. Now, by every measure, these are really great parents. These are people that were professionals. These are people mm-hmm. that have launched kids of their own. Mm-hmm. They are successful adults. They have grandkids that are successful grandkids, and now they're in over their heads. Nobody would argue that those parents didn't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. They did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They knew exactly what they were doing. We've got proof. We've mm-hmm. got proof times mm-hmm. 3 with their mm-hmm. adult kids.
Yep.
But what we don't have is we don't have the right set of skills for that particular kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get help.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you reach out and where there's help available, because therapists are going to have a wide array of arrows in their quiver.
Oh, that's excellent. Makes total sense. Yeah. The other thing that I tell people as a pastor, parents, that children are very resilient. They can work through things given the right opportunity. And pain and difficulties and in life are great opportunities for God to really use for us and give us compassion and mercy for other people. I mean, just because a child may have difficulties does not mean that their life is going to be miserable and terrible and that they'll always be stuck at this spot, right?
Right. And I mean, we've got some great research and information that some of the most difficult kids honestly turn into some of the most successful adults.
As much as my wife and I messed up with our own children, they really came out quite nicely. They've made good, really good adults, and we like them. We like to be around them. And so any parent out there that's feeling like, "Oh, I'm just failing," I can tell you, I fail. I have failed as a father many times. But those words where you come back and say, "You know what? I was wrong," or "I overreacted," that really goes a long ways, because the adults that I see in my office to see me as a pastor are many times adults whose parents never said they were sorry. They never admitted to any kind of mistakes. And it's always easier to forgive somebody when they ask for forgiveness.
Right.
It's harder to work through it when they don't. If you're listening today and you have questions for Dr. Brian, or you'd like me to do another program with him and have ask very specific questions, just email me at pastorbrad@freshhope.us, pastorbrad@freshhope.us, and I'll be sure and get those questions to him. And I'm sure we'll do a follow-up program somewhere along the line here. Here's my question for you. How do I know when my child is needing discipline and is acting up and acting out versus when my child is in pain and acting up or acting out?
Boy, that is a great question. And I think that that is really, boy, that's a tough one to answer. I would say that the needing attention, and one probably good way to try to determine the difference between the two would be when you give them ample attention, how do they do? So kids are going to look for attention regardless of how they're going to get it. And logically, in our minds, we would think, well, they're not going to want to get punished. They're going to want praises. The thing is when a kid is playing quietly, it's easy to ignore them because they're being quiet, unless you've got one of those kids where quiet is suspicious.
Yeah.
But when they're acting out, you have to intervene, and you're all over it. And so we criticize far more than we praise. And that's it's just the way it is, because you're busy, you've got things to do, and you can't just be sitting there doling out praise constantly. But are you spending the time with the kid one-on-one? Are you taking them on dates? Are you playing with them, interacting with them, and giving them some of that attention? That'd be a good way to start, is to see, yeah, they've been misbehaving. They don't necessarily deserve my time, but no, they do. They do deserve your time. And so spending that time with them, see what that does to those behaviors, and see if that acting out goes down, if it changes, because it is the attention from the parent that's going to reinforce the behavior. And it does not matter if it's positive or negative attention.
Yeah.
If you are paying attention to them, you are going to fuel it. And we all know this when we, you know, have that kid that does the, you know, says the swear word or whatever, you're ignoring. They say a word and you say, oh, you don't say that. Guess which word you're going to hear next time. That same one, because they just found a trigger. And so they're going to look for those triggers, and they're going to go after that. But if you're ignoring the good and the bad, the good is going to decrease if you ignore it. And so really giving them and feeding them that attention so that they don't seek it out in a negative way. And then as far as the hurting question, how do I know if they're acting out because they're hurting? I'd say, was there a real abrupt change in the behaviors?
Is there something
that's different, that they were normal, happy-go-lucky, and then it's like a switch got flipped? Something changed. Something's not right. Something's different. You may or may not know what triggered it. You may or may not be able to identify the day or the week or an event or something like that, but something changed. They're just not themselves. And that would be something that would be seen really in between the acting out behaviors, that you can tell something else is wrong. And then that is where, either way, going in and seeing somebody, if you've got a kid that's acting out a lot, getting in, again, talking to somebody that's maybe got some different arrows for you to try out, a different approach, because you're just not making progress with it. If you're parenting as you know how to parent and things are getting better, hallelujah, that's the way it's supposed to work. But when it doesn't work that way, it doesn't mean you're a failure.
It just means that there's a different approach or a different pathway.
Right.
I think that's really important, because those of you who are parents and listening, let me tell you, there's nothing more that Satan would like than to make you feel like a failure and remind you of all your failures and then lie on top of it and tell you you're even more of a failure. You know, the reality is that God can take anything and make it work for our good. And when we as parents are willing to do what we need to do to learn new things or new ways, new approaches, it can turn things around in a heartbeat. The other thing is never, ever feel as though you have the right to give up on your child, or don't give up on them. I tell that to parents over and over, just don't give up. Even though it's hard work and you haven't found the thing that works, keep hang in there. Don't emotionally back off, you know, because what I think sometimes happens is we just say, well, it's a lost cause, you know. And it's only a lost cause if you give up.
We serve a really, really big God.
Who's quite able.
And there is no lost cause.
Yep. And the other thing is get some prayer warriors out there for your kids.
Well, one other thing that I would throw in there that goes back to something you said earlier that I learned in training, and I've repeated it often, is there is no such thing as a good parent. Mm-hmm. There is only a good enough parent. Mm-hmm. Yep. In other words, you're gonna screw up.
Yeah. Yes.
And kids are resilient. Mm-hmm. How many times can you screw up before it affects the kid? And so getting help at the appropriate time
is key.
Is really key.
And you got to swallow your pride.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Because I tell you what, I've been a pastor for nearly 32 years now. I ain't met no perfect parents. I ain't never met any perfect spouses. And I don't have any perfect people in my church.
I've only ever met one who is perfect.
Yeah, and that one died for me.
Right.
Yep. That's very good. That's a good way to close today. So thank you so much, and I appreciate you being with us. Again, my friend, if you'd like to ask a question or would like to hear us cover a certain topic or a certain question that you'd like asked the next time we have Dr. Brian with us, would you please email me at pastorbrad@freshhope.us. And I'm really glad you were listening. Tell your friends about this program. Pass on the information, as well as you can check out about Fresh Hope groups for adults, at least, right now. And we're hoping to restart some groups for teenagers, ultimately. And maybe down the line, the Lord will open the door for us to possibly have some kind of Fresh Hope approach for children even. And we're hopeful that Dr. Brian's going to be able to help us with some of that. Again, thank you very much for being here today. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We'll be back again with another episode very soon. God bless. For more information, go to freshhope.us. That's www.freshhope.us.